Punjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Punjabi Hari. Gopi Janna Balabha, Girvarir Hari. Gopi Janna Balabha, Girvarir Hari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjanaya Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjanaya Yamuna Tira Vanacharya Yamuna Tira Vanacharya Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parvraj Gachara Sotiris Sri Shimanas Bank Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Gijai ISKCON Founder Charya Srila Prabhupada Gijai Samaveda Bhaktivedanta Gijai Gaur Premananda All glories to Simple Devotees All glories to Simple Devotees All glories to Simple Devotees All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthapadaya Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamani Namaste Sarasthi Parshchatai Siddharani Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya We're going to be reading a few verses from Bhagavad Gita, primarily focusing on 5:15, but I want to give a little introduction to this. My topic is Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. Now, this isn't an original title. This is an idea that's been around for many, many years, actually. In fact, in 1981, there was a best-selling book, which probably most of you don't remember, but I thought it was interesting when it came out. It was by Rabbi Harold Kushner, and it was a best-selling book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And basically, it discussed the principal problems of what is called theodicy. Theodicy is a conundrum, which means a confusing, difficult problem, a dilemma, or a riddle of why. If the universe was created and is governed by a God who is of good and loving nature, why is there so much suffering and pain in it? In other words, it's essentially what philosophers call the evidential problem of evil. In other words, why does God allow evil? So the dilemma is God is either all-powerful, or is God all kind and loving and merciful? Because it seems as though if he were all-powerful, he could make everything how he wanted, why would there be suffering and pain? So, you know, there's different ways that people are looking at, and interestingly, the way that Rabbi Kushner explained it, he just decided that God's not all-powerful. He can't control all this suffering. It's just kind of goes on by the nature of free will and just the natural laws of things. And but God is essentially good, but he just can't control us all. Now, most of us would think that that's not a very good definition of God, is it? In other words, if God is the one who is in control of everything, has created everything, you know, each, you know, the entire universes are coming from him, how could he not have more control than that? That's part of the problem that comes up with. But anyway, this problem of the question of evil, why is there evil in the world, why is there suffering, has been debated for generations, for centuries, by philosophers and theologians. Now, there's many different explanations that people give. They say, well, there's the free will defense, that because of free will, God gave humans free will, therefore some people will be evil, some people will be good. But that doesn't really answer, then, why is it that evil people are able to inflict suffering upon people who have chosen to be good, does it? Some people say there's the soul-making theodicy. Suffering is necessary for spiritual growth. Well, we should all be very spiritually advanced since there's so much suffering in this material world. Other people say, what's the best of all possible worlds? One philosopher Leibniz's argument was that God created the best of all possible worlds, limited evil with is necessary for the overall maximum good. I mean, if that's the best God could do, you know, it makes you wonder. And I mean, we know from the Srimad Bhagavatam and if you look at Brahma Samhita, just the incredible creations of the spiritual world of the Lord, the most wonderful planetary systems, Krishna Loka, you know, where there is just the greatest bliss and happiness. So we're saying, well, that's the best God can do. Hard to buy that one. And some people just say that, well, at any rate, in the afterlife, you'll get your just desserts, so whatever happens in this material life, whatever. Again, not real satisfying. Now, unfortunately, Rabbi Kushner did not read the Bhagavad Gita, obviously, or he would have come to a very simple explanation. Not simple, really. It's not. I don't want to say it's simple because, in fact, there's not. I can't find like one verse that explains the whole thing because it's sort of a complex, you know, metaphysical, theological issue. But there's a number of verses, and I picked this one, 5:15, honestly, not as much for the verse, but for the purport, because Prabhupada just wrote a fantastic purport that gives a good explanation of this whole issue. Okay, I'll just, because I have a lot of material here, I'll just read this through. Verse 5:15, Nadate kashachit papam nachaiva sukatam vibho. Agyane namrita gyanam tena muyanti jantava. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activity. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers the real knowledge. Here's Srila Prabhupada's purport. The Sanskrit word vibhu means the Supreme Lord who is full of unlimited knowledge, riches, strength, fame, beauty, and renunciation. He is always satisfied in himself, undisturbed by sinful or pious activity. He does not create a particular situation for any living entity, but the living entity, bewildered by ignorance, desires to be put into certain conditions of life, and thereby his chain of action and reaction begins. A living entity is, by superior nature, full of knowledge. Nevertheless, he is prone to be influenced by ignorance due to his limited power. The Lord is omnipotent, but the living entity is not. The Lord is vibhu, or omniscient, but the living entity is anu, or atomic. Because he is a living soul, he has the capacity to desire by his free will. Such desires fulfilled only by the omnipotent Lord. And so when the living entity is bewildered in his desires, the Lord allows him to fulfill those desires. But the Lord is never responsible for the actions and reactions of the particular situation which may be desired. Being in a bewildered condition, therefore, the embodied soul identifies himself with the circumstantial material body and becomes subjected to the temporary misery and happiness of life. The Lord is the constant companion of living entity as Paramatma or Supersoul, and therefore he can understand the desires of the individual soul as one can smell the flavor of a flower by being nearby it. Desire is a subtle form. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning for the living entity. The Lord fulfills his desire as he deserves. Man proposes and God disposes. The individual is not, therefore, omnipotent in fulfilling his desires. The Lord, however, can fulfill all desires, and the Lord, being neutral to everyone, does not interfere with the desires of the minute, independent living entities. However, when one desires Krishna, the Lord takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that he can attain to him and be eternally happy. Okay, I'm going to stop there. It's a very long prayer report. So, I'm going to read a number of other verses that will sort of fill this out. But the simple answer is this. Yes, God, Krishna, is both omnipotent and loving and just. He is all-powerful and he is all-kind. He is all-merciful, he is just, he is fair, and he has complete power. Omnipotent means, of course, being having full power. Also, he is omniscient, all-knowing. Yeah. Now, this is a little bit different perspective on this issue is approached by different verses. It's a complex topic, so we'll look at this from some different perspectives. The first of these is we have to understand, of course, the distinction of the soul, the self, the jiva, the atma, and the material body. The suffering is temporary and does not affect the eternal soul. So that's important first to understand. Bhagavad Gita 2:20 says, "For the soul there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being." Well, these translations are awkward, aren't they? Anyway, "He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain." And one nice example is given by Balaram preaching to Rukmini after Rukmi is captured by Krishna. This is Bhagavatam 10:54. We don't see Balaram giving too many philosophical treatises, but once in a while he does in the Bhagavatam. Here he says, he talks about when we are awake, we know that a dream is illusory, but it's very real when we're in the dream state. And in a very vivid dream, the memory of it continues even when we're awake. It sort of continues onward. We still sort of think we're in that dream. So similarly, when we're very attached to the body and very attached to the senses and sense gratification, that body illusion continues in that same way. That's how it's described. Now, of course, to say, well, there may be suffering, but you're not your body, is not entirely satisfactory either. That's sometimes is the simplistic answer we give. Oh, Prabhu, you're not your body. You know, don't worry about it. Well, no. Suffering is experienced by the living entity. Even if the soul is aloof from material pain and pleasure, the conditioned consciousness certainly experiences suffering. When you think about it, who is suffering? When you're experiencing some suffering, say, to your body, who is actually suffering? Well, of course, you can say it's the senses, it's the body, it's all of that, the gross and subtle by the mind. But certainly, there must ultimately be consciousness, and consciousness means the presence of the soul. So the soul is, in a sense, experiencing by its conditioned nature, thinks that it is suffering because the soul is identifying with this body and the senses. So because of that identification, the suffering seems very real to us. So we also have to understand this concept of karma. Again, this is not a complete answer. It's a little more nuanced than that. But basically, we understand that we do create the conditions for our own suffering from our past activities. I think it's very difficult for those in some of the Western religious traditions to understand this concept or understand this conundrum because they have basically a one-life system. If you see that there's only one life that you came in and there is no continuity of continuing or past lives or future lives, then it tends to not make sense. But once you understand the process of transformation of the soul by karma through different bodies, different stages of life, it makes it come together a little bit better and it's much more comprehensible. So Bhagavad Gita 8:6 says, "Yang yang vapi smran bhavan twajuchante kalevaram tang tang evaiti kuntaya sarat bhava bhavita." Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. So, the consciousness of the time of death determines our next birth. So, whatever I'm experiencing, suffering, happiness in this lifetime, I have created from past lifetimes. In the purport, Prabhupada says, of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death. So this life creates one's next life. So in other words, all of our activities, our thoughts, our desires, all of that cumulative comes together, and that's going to affect the totality of our consciousness, so that at the time of death, that consciousness then will continue. When the gross body dies, the soul is carried on the subtle body of mind, intelligence, and false ego, and that soul continues in the subtle body and enters into the new gross body, consisting of the five elements. So that's the process that's going on. And so we received our new body due to the laws of karma, our actions and reactions, and the basic laws of nature and laws of karma. So we create those bodies through our desires, our thoughts, and especially those activities. And those develop the consciousness for the next lifetime. Here's a nice explanation that Srila Prabhupada gives of the process of samsara and transmigration. This is from a purport, 7.13.27. Let's see. If one does not act for the satisfaction of Krishna, he must be entangled in the reactions of fruitive activities. By pious activity, one is elevated to the higher planetary systems, and by impious activity, one is degraded to lower species of life, in which he is punished by the laws of nature. In the lower species of life, there's an evolutionary process. And when the term of the living entity's imprisonment or punishment in the lower species is finished, he is again offered a human form and given a chance to decide for himself which way he should plan. If he again misses the opportunity, he is again put into the cycle of birth and death, going sometimes higher and sometimes lower, turning on the samsara chakra, the wheel of material existence. So the suffering that is experienced in this world, we can see, is really part of the continuum of a cyclical process that the living entity is going through lifetime after life, transmigrating from one body to another, where the actions in one lifetime or cumulative actions of several lifetimes create the next life. And so therefore, one can honestly say that we create our own suffering. Clear, right? We create our own suffering by those cumulative activities. So it's not just that we get whatever we desire. Prabhupada said desire and deserve, right? So in other words, you might say, oh, I'd like to be a millionaire in my next lifetime, but I also have to qualify. So that's the thing. In other words, pious activities, good activities, will help qualify us for a better lifetime, and sinful activities, activities which are ungodly, unreligious, hurtful, harmful to other people, those will qualify us for lower births, including births in animal and plant species of life. So that's going on through 8,400,000 species of life. And while it sounds like it's somewhat of a mechanical process, it's not really mechanical. The laws are mechanical, but it's all handled personally. Krishna deals with everything personally. We are all persons. And the first thing we should understand is we are not being forced. Now, it may seem like once one comes into a material body and is under the modes of nature, and sometimes it's said like that, that we're almost forced by the laws of nature to act in certain ways. But we have actually chosen that. Even that situation where we seem to be propelled by the modes of nature is part of something that we have chosen in the past. So the idea of free will is very, very important. And the nature of the jiva, the atma, the soul, the self, we do possess free will, as does Krishna. And as a part, an umpsa of the Lord, the jiva possesses similar qualities. In 7.7.19, the verse says, Atma refers to the Supreme Lord or the living entities. Both of them are spiritual, free from birth and death, free from deterioration, and free from material contamination. They are individual. They are knowers of the external body, and they are the foundations or shelter of everything. They are free from material change. They are self-illuminated. They are the cause of all causes, and they are all-pervading. They have nothing to do with the material body, and therefore they're always uncovered. With these transcendental qualities, one who is actually learned must give up the illusory concept of life in which one thinks, I am this material body, and everything in relationship to this body is mine. So the living entity shares the qualities of independence or free will of the Supreme Lord. Krishna is Svarat. He is the supreme independent. He has complete free will, complete choice. He can do whatever he wants. Now, we don't have that type of free will. We don't have that kind of power. We're very, as Prabhupada said, we are Anu, very tiny. We are not Vibhu, very great. But at the same time, we still have that small amount of independence. And that's very important to understand that nature of the soul. There's a really nice description of the qualities of the soul in the Paramatma Sandarbha by Śrīla Jīva Gosvāmī, where the first half of the book, he describes the qualities of the jiva, and then later he describes the qualities of the jiva in relationship to Paramatma, Atma, and of course Paramatma. So he talks about the eternal qualities of the Atma. First, every single one of us, each Atma is individual. We are, of course, separate consciousness from all other jivas. There's no like mass merging of one big cosmic consciousness or any of that stuff we sometimes hear. No, each one of us has an individual personality, an individual consciousness, separate from all other jivas. The Atma is conscious. That means we are aware. And Jiva Goswami says also, we are also self-aware. So in other words, we are aware and we're also self-aware. What does that mean? I mean, in other words, we're aware of ourself as a being. As an individual separate being, there's that awareness that is there, and at the same time, there's awareness of everything else in our perceptual field, okay? So the soul also has Shakti, has powers, little powers, but we do have those Shaktis as powers. One is that we are eternal, Sat. Also, we have full knowledge, Chit. The Chit potency is there within the Jiva, so all knowledge is originally there within us. So this process of Krishna consciousness is a process of unveiling or bringing out that eternal knowledge that is there within each one of us eternally. Okay. So we have awareness of the self as a jiva. We have awareness of objects in the material world. Of course, the soul pervades the body and gives consciousness to the body. The Atma is also an enjoyer. He has also the quality of ananda, or bliss. Sat Chit Ananda. Those are the qualities of the soul as well as, of course, the qualities of the Supreme Lord. And he has desire. We talk about, of course, material desires, but there's also spiritual desire. Desire is there within the soul. That is there as well. Now, of course, that pure desire is desire to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know. Also, the Atma is a doer, a cause of action, has volition. So being an actor or doer implies the Atma has volition or free will. So that is there eternally, okay? Now, the only problem with free will is that the Atma is also qualitatively, we are called tatashta shakti. Tatashta shakti means that we are marginal. Marginal means not quite the same nature of Krishna as Krishna is God, the Lord. And we are certainly not of the set nature of the material nature, so it's kind of, but we have the tendency to become covered over by the material nature. So we may become covered by the modes when we're in contact with Prakriti and misuse that free will to commit sinful activities, which brings us into the whole cycle of karmic reaction. So one might ask, why must there be free will? Doesn't this bring about suffering in the material world by its misuse? Why doesn't Krishna just create us to always love him? Wouldn't that make it easy? You know? We don't have any choice. We just have to love Krishna. What's the problem with that? Would it be love? No. It's not actually love. Love implies choice. There must be free will. There must be choice to have actual love. I'm going to read this little discussion Prabhupada had with a devotee named Vipina. Actually, this was in Potomac in 76. I think I was there at the time. Prabhupada said, so even in Vaikuntha, if I desire, why shall I serve Krishna? Why don't I become Krishna? I immediately fall down. That is natural. A servant is serving the master. Sometimes he may think, I could become the master. Thinking like that, trying to become God, that is delusion. You cannot become God. But Pina says, why doesn't Krishna protect us from that desire? Prabhupada, he is protecting. He says, you rascal, don't desire, surrender unto me. But you're a rascal and you don't do this. But Pina, why doesn't he save me from thinking like that? That means you would lose your independence, Pina, and no love. Yes, that is force. Prema, is it love? You love me, otherwise I will kill you? Is that love? So Krishna does not want to become a lover like that on the point of revolver. You love me, otherwise I shall kill you. That is not love. That is threatening. Love is reciprocal, voluntarily. Good exchange of feelings. Then there is love, not by force. But isn't it by force anyway? If we don't love Krishna, we suffer. Prabhupada, that is your business. You'll suffer. But Krishna does not force you. He says, you love me, you'll be happy. You don't love me, you suffer. But that is your business. It's your choice. Okay. So Krishna gives us, everyone, all that we desire and all that we deserve. He's impartial. He says it's in the Bhagavad Gita that, you know, he has no friends or enemies. He's impartial to all. So we might say, can Krishna understand the suffering of the conditioned jiva? In other words, does Krishna actually understand that we are suffering this material world? It's interesting, quite actually, that could be a whole class in itself. And Srila Jiva Goswami raises this question in the Bhaktisandarbha. He quotes 10.10.14. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam that says, by seeing their faces, one whose body has been pricked by pins can understand the pain of others who are pinpricked. Realizing this pain is the same for everyone, he does not want others to suffer in this way. But one who has never been pricked by pins cannot understand this pain. Well, it's kind of a simple analogy that I think we can all follow. So Krishna does not have a material body. So does he understand our suffering in these material bodies? Krishna understands, he knows our suffering, but he doesn't actually experience it. Krishna cannot experience our suffering. Why? Because that suffering is based upon the material modes of nature, our material bodies and senses. Krishna has no material body, has no material senses. Everything is totally 100% spiritual. Therefore, he does not actually experience the pain of the material world, although he is fully conscious of it. He's fully conscious of everything. Rather, he tries to bestow his mercy on the jivas to try to help us out of the situation. And the primary process that Krishna gives is giving his mercy is through his devotees, and particularly, of course, through the guru. That is why the position of the guru, the position of the devotees, is so important in our Vaishnava philosophy, because that is the means, that is the process, that is the instrument that Krishna uses to help bring all of these suffering conditioned souls back to their rightful condition, their rightful situation of understanding their relationship with Krishna, surrendering to Krishna, learning to love Krishna, and serve him through the nine processes of devotional service. I have a very long section here that I put in parentheses, if time permits, which I don't think it will, which is from Jiva Goswami, of why doesn't Krishna give his mercy directly. It's one of the best metaphysical explanations of it that I've seen, but I'll just have to leave you in suspense for another day on that one. No. Okay, let's see. Okay, real quick. Here's Jiva Goswami said, this is Anucheda 180 of Bhaktisandarbha. How can one actually see the Lord? The cause must be found. If one proposes that the Lord's mercy is the first cause, it can only be considered a secondary cause. That mercy is not bestowed independently by the Lord to material persons suffering unlimitedly in samsara. That is impossible. Mercy, a change of heart, occurs when one's heart is touched by another's suffering. In scriptures say the Lord is different from the jiva, since he is always full of the highest bliss and untouched by sin. Just as darkness is not suitable for light, it is impossible for mercy to manifest, since it is impossible for his heart to be contaminated by the darkness of suffering. Thus, the suffering of the materialist in this world is not experienced by the Lord, who existing at all times is capable of doing or not doing otherwise. Thus, only the mercy of the devotees remains. Though the devotees are also not affected by suffering in the material world, they sometimes remember it, like when remembering the suffering in dreams after awakening. Thus, they show mercy to the people of this world. In this way, Narada showed mercy to Nalakuvara and Manigriva. And of course, Narada, of course, remembers his past lifetime, when, you know, before he becomes completely purified, when he was the maidservant's son. And, you know, so he remembers the suffering of the material world. And therefore, even when he's this completely liberated, you know, transcendental traveler, Narada Muni, he can extend his mercy because he understands the suffering of people like Nalakuvara and Manigriva. Bhakti's been described and will later be described as the Lord's special Shakti, which enters the devotee and softens him. It begins to operate nicely in combination with Dainya humility. Thus, the Lord's mercy, which exists in the Lord's devotee, has devotee association as its vehicle, or the devotee's mercy is its vehicle, and thus passes into other jivas. Anyway, that's the basic process, that through the agency of Krishna's devotees, he extends his mercy throughout the world. Well, we might also ask, does he arrange all this transmigration at each birth, or is it automatic? Is it a mechanical process? Is it like a checkbox thing? You did so many things, and you get this, you get that. Well, there is a mechanical aspect to it. I mean, there is action and reaction. That's certainly there. And in fact, I mean, some of the scriptures like Manusamhita will describe all kinds of, you get this reaction for this, you know, thing that you do. But at the same time, Krishna has a personal hand in it, particularly for devotees. He says, Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto matat spitir gyanam apoanam cha vidaischa sarvaraham eva vejo vidanta krideva vid eva chaham. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. So he tells Arjuna of his personal relationship with us, that he is Paramatma in the heart of every living entity. He's the source of remembrance, our knowledge, our forgetfulness. And here he's discussed in relationship to the transmigration to different bodies. So the jiva forgets his past lifetimes, but his state of consciousness is restored in the new body, and that's, of course, all through the agency of Paramatma. So our current consciousness prepares for the future body. And Krishna knows and directs each living entity's existence because he is omnipotent and omniscient. It says, the Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of material energy, Bhagavad Gita 18:61. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has a nice purport on this verse where he describes that the first part of the verse, Krishna helps the living entity while in the material world. In other words, you know, he is there helping all living entities, giving them knowledge. And Prabhupada gives examples of things like, even like the animals, like, you know, showing, you know, how does a bird know how to migrate? Well, you know, it's all Krishna's super soul. Krishna is directing the wanderings of all the living entities. But then he also explains how he helps us to achieve liberation. So Krishna sends the Vedas to enlighten the conditioned souls. That's the part where he says, after, you know, that by him he is the knower of the Vedas, etc. So he provides intelligence, and his desire is that everybody return to him. Bhagavad Gita 7:19, it says, after many births and deaths, he was actually acknowledged, surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. And then he gives special help to those devotees of his who are sincerely trying to come back to him, trying to know him and trying to love him and serve him. Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita 10:10 and 10:11, To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they come to me. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with a shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Okay, I think we'll stop at that point. So the point is here, is Krishna all powerful or is Krishna all merciful? He is both. All of the above. Krishna is supreme and complete. All right. Okay, I'll stop at this point. Question, Gunga Narayan Prabhu? Here comes the microphone.
You mentioned in one point in your class that Krishna isn't subject to our suffering, So how does he know how we're suffering?
Well, he's within our heart, he's part of Matva.
Yeah, I know, but still, even though he's in our heart.
Well, there's a difference between know and experience. That was the distinction I was trying to make. Krishna doesn't experience the suffering because he doesn't have a material body. But he knows it. He knows everything. He's the creator of the material energy.
I'm going to say.
Okay?
You read this in the first purport that you read of the verse that you started with. Mm-hmm. It says in the purport that one can understand a flower by its smell. Or let's say you have some foodstuffs and it's rotten. You can smell it. You don't have to eat it
right. To
know that it's rotten. So Krishna's in our heart, but he can still understand our suffering by sort of indirectly. He's not direct.
No, he understands it, yes.
That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, of course, he understands it. He just doesn't personally experience material suffering.
Exactly.
But he understands it.
And also, it's an interesting thing that we fall under Mahamaya, but Krishna also has a Maya, and that's Yogamaya. So sometimes it appears that he doesn't understand something, or he failed at doing something, or he lost the battle, or any of these different
things. To further his pastimes. Yes, Yogamaya assists Krishna in his pastimes. So when Krishna appears to be in some ignorance or appears to not know something, it's usually to increase the loving pastimes with his devotees. Anyway, that's a whole other.
Thank you.
That gets complicated.
Your class was great, by the way.
Oh, thank you, bro. Others over here?
Ladies.
One of the most important parts of your class that, really, I could really feel it was that idea that Krishna, he's a person and he's personal. Mm-hmm. And that always we have that choice from wherever we are. If we want to know him better, then he completely reaches out. They say that you take one step towards God and he takes, a thousand or a million steps towards you.
Yeah.
So, it's all by desire, right? It's like if you don't desire to know God or love God, he lets you do whatever you want.
Exactly.
And even though the appearance of opulence or happiness so-called happiness may be there, that separation, actually there's a word for it in German, I think Sünde or something like that, means separated from God. Like there's really no pleasure in comparison to that of being close to God, and having that reciprocation. And I know in the verse Tate Nukampam, in the purport there, Prabhupada explains that for a devotee, sometimes it may appear like a punishment, but it's not really. It's a way of bringing him closer. So you really never know how, because Krishna is a person, he wants every living being to be with him, right? And not just for him to, for the person to love God, for God to be able to reunite with that soul.
There's another really important point here that I didn't want to emphasize so much because it's a Sunday feast and everything, but it's mostly devotees here. Everyone's devotees here, really. Krishna has a different relationship with the devotees than with the non-devotees. For his devotees, yes, Krishna is reaching out to us. Krishna is giving all help. Krishna is very active in that relationship. As you said, we take one step towards Krishna. Krishna, you know, takes many steps towards us. Or he is always trying to help the devotees, and so that's a very important point. Yeah.
In one sense, too, like everybody's a devotee, right?
Yeah.
Some realize it. Some don't realize it.
As soon as someone begins to realize it, then Krishna says, "Oh, this is my devotee. You just now you're over in that category."
Just like the highest platform, right, is someone who sees everything, everyone as a devotee.
That's the Uttama Adhikari platform.
Yeah.
Yeah, the highest devotee sees because everyone is.
Right.
Everyone is a part and parcel of God. Everyone has an original relationship with God, and one who's on the highest spiritual platform can understand that.
And doesn't it even hurt Krishna somehow?
What's that?
Doesn't it even hurt Krishna somehow when someone is separate from him in some way, you know, that he feels that absence?
We have examples of that. I think I can't think of too many. Well, one I can think of sort of the positive aspect is in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, you know, when Gopal goes through all of his whole journey and he finally comes back. And what does Krishna do? He embraces him, says, "Finally, after so long, you're back. I'm so glad you're." Yeah. Right. That's one good example I can think of. Yeah. Yes, Krishna very much wants us. Yes.
Hi, Krishna Prabhu. Nice class. I just wanted to ask, what is the context in which Jiva Goswami actually mentions this thing about Krishna not being able to experience the suffering? But
the context is he understands how Krishna's mercy comes through the devotees, through the role of the devotee, and how you know, Krishna uses the devotees to bring people back to him in the material world.
Okay.
Right.
Haribo, why do good things happen to bad people?
I was going to say that's the converse of it, too. Because they had good karma in their last lifetime, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, some of our current leaders must have done something, you know, something good to get something this lifetime. Who knows? Krishna also says, doesn't he say the laws of action-reaction are very intricate and hard to understand, right, in the Bhagavad Gita? So, I mean, it is complex. It's hard, you can't really tease it all apart. Why did this person do this to get this and that, you know? Oh, no. But yes.
So in the cycle of reincarnations, like how a plant or something that doesn't have free will, is it just an automatic elevation through the cycle? Or how do other life forms like behave?
Yeah,
morally.
I understand what you're saying. That's a real good question. Actually, I think Prabhupada kind of touched upon it in the purport. Yes, it is more or less automatic. Karma is actually created at the human platform. So in other words, you may create a whole set of lifetimes from your activity in this life, including plants, animals, etc., who do not have the same kind of free will as you're saying. They really can't make those, say, moral choices. You know, I mean, if a tiger eats a deer, that's just his quota. That's what he does. It's not a moral choice, right, one way or the other. Anything like that. So, yeah, and then as one eventually goes through those lifetimes, evolved, that's what evolution really is, the spiritual evolution of evolving up to higher species of life till one comes back to the human form, and then at the human form, one has the opportunity again. Right. It's a good question. Thank you.
Sometimes that can be interrupted, correct? Like when we were in Miami and they talked about prasadam. So if you know, an animal gets spiritual food, he gets some kind of liberation.
Oh, know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or even just chanting the holy name, like everything benefits from it. Every tree every flower, every person. So, you know, things are kind of automatic, but then it's a whole different thing when the spiritual sound vibration is going on.
It's a, it's everyone. A process that's called agata sukriti. Agata sukriti, agata means unknowing. So even without your knowledge, you may be gaining spiritual benefits. So if I'm hearing the holy name or if I'm taking prasadam, I may not have any idea what this is, but I'm still gaining the benefit. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that through the accumulation of agata sukriti over one lifetime or many lifetimes, then one comes to the position of becoming a devotee. All right. Anything else? Yeah, in the back.
Wonderful talk. There was a lecture that Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj gave, and in the question, somebody asked him a question sort of like this. And part of his answer was that everyone is subject to the threefold miseries, but suffering is optional. I just thought it was really nice how he put
that's
that.
Good. That's a very advanced devotees. Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely correct, though.
In Bhagavad Gita 15.6, it says, Jadgatta nanivartante. Once you come back to me, never go back.
Yeah.
So that's also, I mean, free will is there, but jiva
don't come back. It says one who comes never return. In other words, it's possible, obviously, to leave the spiritual world. Here we are, right? But the idea is that once one returns, I guess probably it's kind of like you've learned your lesson. You know, you've gotten it. And probably was asked about this once. He said, could you theoretically come back again? He says, you could. You have free will, but you won't. You know, you know better by this point. You know, I mean, we've got a pretty good dose of it here, I think. You know, we're not going to want to do this again, given the choice. Thank you. Anything else? What, over here?
Thank you for a very nice class. I have an announcement from Book Distribution Ministry, Vaisheshika Prabhu. We are going to take a photograph in front of Prabhupada. So please stay tuned. And this post with the poster that says Bhadra, 100,000 in 8 sets. So we are going to be taking a photograph here.
What are you doing? We're doing a photograph? A group, the whole, everyone? Everyone, okay.
Yeah, so please, every... Yeah, we want a group photo.
Okay. I guess we're done. Okay.
No.
No, I'm just kidding. All right. No.
You should also join, please.
We're done. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hari Bol. Now, go ahead.
Tamar Prabhu ki jai. Please join Tamar
Prabhu. Srila Prabhupada.